From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Control. Sometimes it's something we lose.
They use the condom, but like sometimes you be in the moment and the condom is not there, so they just go along with it. They don't really think about the consequences that may or may not happen.
And sometimes it's something we're not sure we have.
They build up a great trust with these women. They're very nice and they're friendly. They make it seem like they really care about you. But at the end of the day, you're a slut who got pregnant, and now we have to help you so you never get in this situation again.
Birth control, controlling the social media story, and the battle for control over the Republican platform. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Regardless of your job, where you're from, or your gender, you want to feel in control, right? But control means many things to many people. To tell your side of the story, to have fulfilling work and a steady paycheck, and importantly, to be able to make choices regarding your own health. So, we begin by talking with the woman who leads Planned Parenthood, the largest health provider for women in the country. I spoke with Cecile Richards at NPR's New York Bureau about healthcare and the role young Latinas are taking in leading the conversation about reproductive rights and control in our country. What are you seeing when you say that you see these Latina leaders who are getting more engaged with the conversation about reproductive rights? I mean, paint that picture for me of these young women, where you're seeing them and what are they talking about?
As we celebrated the anniversary of Roe, the 41st anniversary, there were a number of young Latinas there. And there is a growing understanding of the intersectionality, they would say, between immigrants' rights, women's rights, GLBT rights, reproductive rights. And that was a large part of the conversation, that as these movements are now melding together, the power of that is palpable, to see these young women and young men who are embracing an idea in this country that they can do and be anything. And that is, it's very powerful. I think it's a much more powerful dynamic than we've seen in, I'd say, the last couple of decades.
So what in particular are these Latinas talking about? Are they saying, you know what, there's a perception that we are all conservative, that we're deeply Catholic, that we don't support choice, and we want to break that narrative? Or are they saying, on a personal level, this really matters to me because of a personal issue?
I don't actually think they have any of the hang-ups that the general public does. I mean, I think I run into people all the time who have complete misconceptions about how Latinos think about reproductive health, reproductive rights, when in fact, all the research shows that that group of individuals are as supportive of sex education, of access to birth control, of access to reproductive health care as anyone else in the U.S. The more that there is a growing understanding that basic human rights all are a part of one movement is very powerful.
So what do you think is the untold story about Latinas and their concerns around reproductive rights?
Well, we know at Planned Parenthood, as a healthcare provider to 3 million folks every year, there is enormous disparate access to all healthcare, but reproductive healthcare included. And in fact, Latinas are less likely to have a regular doctor. They are less likely to go for care. And that's why we see, really tragically, less early detection of cancer, less access to family planning services, less basic access to healthcare. Of course, part of the Affordable Care Act is establishing that everyone has a right to health care. It's important to me at Planned Parenthood, not only as a movement, but as the largest healthcare provider to women in this country, that one, there are millions more Latinas now that are eligible for healthcare coverage and health insurance, not just Latinas, a lot of women in this country don't know what's available to them under the Affordable Care Act. We're actually now working specifically in Florida and Texas in a massive door-to-door outreach and working with folks who don't have health insurance, helping them actually enroll.
So Planned Parenthood does a poll about Latino-Latina attitudes. What else did you discover in this poll, and why did you decide to do the poll?
Well, it's because I think one of the, as we look at the disparate need for access, you want to make sure that you're understanding what are the needs of the community, not just what do I think the needs are, but what are actually folks saying. And really what largely we found was that attitudes and needs of the Latino population, not that different from the rest of the population in the United States. One of the interesting findings was that in terms of attitudes towards safe and legal abortion, attitudes towards reproductive rights, frankly, very, very similar in the Latino community. And I think there are misconceptions. We are dealing with right now in the United States this continuing fight over whether women should have access to birth control. And there's a lot of folks will assume that somehow Latinas have maybe because they are Catholic or their country of origin have some issue with birth control. Latinas are as likely to use birth control if it's available and if it's affordable as anyone else. And so to me, that's the role of Planned Parenthood, is to close that gap of access.
When you think about the conversation now that we're still discussing reproductive rights, abortion rights, sex education, it seems like three steps forward, two steps back.
I wish I could say that I disagree with you, but that is the situation. But I think the difference here, and what is important that for me that people understand, is for the American people in general, including Latinos, these are settled issues. They believe that birth control should be available. They believe that sex education is critical to the well-being of their sons and daughters. And they believe that abortion should be safe and it should be legal. And they believe, as we do at Planned Parenthood, that if we could do more to provide preventive care, education, and access to birth control, the abortion rate in this country would go down. Unfortunately, there are politicians who I believe are using women for their own political ends, their own political purposes. We've seen that in Texas, unfortunately, over the last several years. But the attitudes of politicians do not mirror the attitudes of the American people.
So your hopes, Cecile Richards, in terms of what you would like to see, what you expect to see in terms of Latina engagement on this issue in the future?
What I would like to see in the future is what I saw when we celebrated the 41st anniversary of Roe, which were young people of all different walks of life and persuasions and ethnicities and races coming together about reproductive justice. To me, it is when women and men and young people come together about all kinds of rights, about women's rights, reproductive rights, immigrants' rights, LGBT rights, and understand that it's all part of the same, it's all part of one movement. That is what's powerful. That was what gives me hope that this country is changing and young people are going to lead that change.
Cecile Richards, thank you so much for being on Latino USA.
It's wonderful to see you again. Thank you.
Cecile Richards is the president of Planned Parenthood. Last week, Republicans released a one-page document stating their immigration reform principles, testing the water for support in their caucus. To some, this signals a potential desire to find solutions to America's broken immigration system. But there's an internal debate in the Republican Party about whether or not to address this issue before the midterm elections in November. So who's got control over the Republican platform on immigration? In order to understand the current debate within the Republican Party, we're speaking with Pilar Marrero, a political analyst and journalist at La Opinión newspaper in Los Angeles. Pilar Marrero, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
Actually, the release of this platform discussion happened while I was on a plane. And I land and all of a sudden my Twitter is just like, what do you think? This is huge. This is a big deal. Oh, my God. The Republicans, there's been a... And I started looking and reading the actual language. I questioned the immense, sense of breakthrough on the part of the Republicans. So is there really something that has changed the conversation? Or is this plain politics
yet again.
Yeah, I know how you felt, because I felt the same way when I read the principles. You know, it feels strange that people would congratulate the Republicans for coming out with something that it's only a principle, not even a bill, when the Senate has already passed a whole bill.
I have heard seasoned people saying yet again that they expect to see some kind of immigration reform passed within a matter of months. Yes or no?
I have my doubts. I personally think that they might be introducing this just as a way to warm up, maybe introduce a bill later on or two, because, you know, as you know, they don't want to have a whole big bill, but they want to have little bills that deal with different aspects. And in my opinion, what they want is to avoid the pressure on the president to act administratively, which will be there. He obviously can't stop all deportations, but, he will be pressured to think about expanding some of the protections of DACA, for example.
Pilar, for people who don't quite know, when you're talking about an increasing pressure on the president to act administratively, well, describe what that pressure looks like and where is it coming from?
Well, it's coming from the communities, because immigration laws have become more and more strict over time, and enforcement has become more and more strict over time. You know, one of the things that came out of that retreat in the Republican Party is that Republicans will not act because they don't trust the president will enforce immigration laws. Well, you know, 2 million deported, you know, the president that has deported more people than any other president in recent history, it's enforcement of immigration law. So, you know, he's being pressured to stop deporting the people that could potentially, you know, be benefited by an immigration reform.
So on the one hand, the pressure to, you know, have the president act administratively. On the other hand, the Republicans are saying, even if we do move on anything, let us just remind you that there will be no special path to citizenship.
Yeah, and that can be confusing for people because, you know, no special path doesn't mean there's no path. Okay, so let's be clear about that. So they want to say something to their base to the effect of, we're not giving amnesty to these people. So we're not giving them citizenship. Well, you never get citizenship when you legalize. It takes years for you to get citizenship anyway. What they want to do, from what I hear, is they want to give some kind of legal status, and then they will allow people to go through regular process. Now, on the other hand, you know, this whole idea that you're rewarding people with citizenship, well, you know, it happened all through our history. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was an immigration law passed that left a lot of Europeans out. And Europeans started coming illegally here. And they got amnestied. So, you know, and this happened over and over and over again in our history. Why wouldn't it happen now? I mean, these people are here to, you know, they came here for the same reason people 100 years ago came here.
We thank you so much, Pilar Marrero from La Opinión, speaking to us from KPCC in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Coming up on Latino USA, kids facing pressure to have sex as early as
middle school, actually. Everybody always teasing people because they're a virgin and everything like that, so it pressures them to have sex more.
Is the safe sex message reaching los chiquillos? Stay with us. No se vayan.
Perdimos el control.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about control. Now, here's something you might not know. Other than condoms, the intrauterine device, or the IUD, is the most common form of birth control in the world. But here in the States, there are lots of women who haven't even heard of it. So what's the deal? Why is the rest of the world using them? But before we can understand that, we have to know what the IUD is. So we asked an expert.
Hi, my name is Melissa Gilliam.
Dr. Gilliam is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Chicago.
The IUD sits in the uterus. There are two types of IUDs. The copper one, it's plastic, and it's shaped like a T, but it has two small arms, and on them, they have little circles of copper. And the idea is that it sets up a sterile inflammatory response, and it almost makes the uterus hostile to sperm, so it doesn't travel.
There is another type of IUD, but instead of using copper, it releases a hormone that circulates in the uterus.
It's the most highly effective method and works as effectively as sterilization, but it's reversible.
So if it's so popular and effective, why don't more women know about it?
The IUD is an old form of contraception, but it's had a particular history in the United States. The one that gets the most attention is something called the Dalkon Shield.
The Dalkon Shield was an IUD model that became infamous in the early 70s. An estimated 200,000 American women testified they were injured by the device. They claimed the IUD had given them pelvic infections. In some extreme cases, they said it left them sterilized, and American women swore off the IUD. Research has since shown that the cause and effect relationship between the device and the injuries weren't so clear-cut. In any case, the Dalkon Shield is off the market, and there are newer models in its place.
The modern IUD has typically been marketed to women who have already had children. In some ways, that's a marketing choice. The fertility is established. There are no issues. But in terms of the actual data on causing infertility, that's not true. And so women who have used the IUD actually return to normal fertility and can have pregnancies.
And there are still the misconceptions.
The second thing that we hear is that the IUD migrates. There is a small risk that it can be expelled, but not that it would suddenly migrate.
While misinformation or just a lack of information might keep women away, the IUD can be helpful in situations some people might not even think about.
In particular, the levonorgestrel IUD, the one that causes the hormone to circulate in the uterus, it also makes it so that young girls don't have periods. And so it's actually been very effective in my practice for girls who have a need for very effective pregnancy prevention and may have cognitive or other disabilities that mean that it's very difficult for them to take pills or use other forms.
It makes sense. Young women with special needs still get periods, so the simplicity of the IUD can affect their quality of life. And for all women, there are some serious health benefits.
Both the copper IUD and the levonorgestrel IUD prevent cancer of the uterus. The levonorgestrel IUD prevents anemia, bleeding, prevents the pain from crampy periods.
Right now, the IUD makes up only 8% of the birth control market in the U.S., but it's increasing in popularity. One surprising reason? Latina immigrants.
The national data shows that Latinos who are non-U.S. born have about a 20% IUD use rate, whereas U.S. born Latinas are closer to the 7-8%.
Mothers from outside the U.S. don't know about the Dalkon Shield stigma. They also come from places where the IUD is more common, so their daughters are more open to it.
That additional endorsement was helpful, and when it wasn't there, then many more misconceptions and rumors abounded.
Ultimately, it's still up to women what method works best for them. But to make decisions, you need the information. While IUDs are popular outside the U.S., the most popular form of birth control around the world is still our old friend, the condom. Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop talks to some New York City high schoolers about safe sex.
sex. It's pretty much everyone's favorite topic. And that includes this group of New York City teenagers.
My name is Brian Maldonado, and I'm from Brooklyn.
My name is Dakari. I'm 16, and I'm from Manhattan.
I'm Peter Henry. I'm 17, and I'm from Queens.
My name is Patrick Hughes.
My name is Ajua Bulma. I'm 17. I'm from Queens.
My name is Ra. I'm 18.
These kids are peer educators with Teens Pact, a program operated by New York's Community Healthcare Network. They run sex ed workshops in schools and community centers around the city. The idea is that it could be easier for teens to talk with each other about sex than with grown-ups. Here's Brian Maldonado.
I mean, they might not listen to their parents, but some teens are influenced by their friends, so if they hear it from us, then maybe we'll lead them in the right direction.
The peer educators agreed to meet with me and talk a little bit about what high schoolers are saying today about safe sex. So the first question I want to ask is about condoms. Generally, when you talk to your peers, what are they saying about them?
Like, the general youth only know about condoms. I think there's, like, other things that they should be learning about, like the IUDs. And
yeah, basically, parents just teach them about condoms and just use a condom.
Sorry. I was having a conversation with a peer, right? They said, the guy lasts longer with a condom. So I guess, like, to promote healthier or safer sex, they can use that.
Use a condom. This is something these teens know because they've been hearing it their whole lives. But it wasn't always that way. The rise of condom use, especially among teenagers, is actually something of a public health miracle.
You know, I remember when people said teenagers are not going to use condoms. Well, those people were proved wrong.
This is John Santelli, a public health professor at Columbia University.
Condoms are, they're not always the most popular method for some obvious reasons. And what we saw beginning in the 1980s were these huge increases. Economies doubled and tripled.
What happened, Santelli says, was a new and very scary disease called AIDS, which seemed to be spreading out of control.
And people were very worried that young people were going to be the next group that was going to be getting infected.
A lot of federal money was pumped into schools for sex ed, and it worked. The Center for Disease Control found that 85% of teen boys used condoms their first time. 60% of teens said they used condoms the last time they had sex. And the numbers show that Black and Latino teenagers are using condoms more than white high schoolers.
When you hear from friends, peers that say they don't like to use them, or if you ever hear that, what are the reasons they give and kind of what is your response?
Most people that I know, they use the condom, but like sometimes you be in the moment and the condom is not there, so they just go along with it. They don't really think about the consequences that may or may not happen.
It's not all about condoms. There are a bunch of other so-called teen risk behaviors that public health people track, including whether teens are having sex at all. It might surprise you to hear that the amount of teen sex has actually fallen since the 90s.
One question I have is, do you feel that high school students are feeling a certain amount of peer pressure to be having sex?
Not really, but I think mostly in middle school, actually. Everybody always teasing people because they're a virgin and everything like that, so it pressures them to have sex more. But once you get into high school, you start to get a little bit more mature, understand like, oh, being a virgin is actually okay, and like I could wait for the right person and stuff like that.
It's mostly like the media, basically, and like what they portray. So you kind of like want to follow after that. Some people, not everybody.
Do you find when you talk to your peers that they're more concerned about pregnancies when they're talking about safe sex, or concerned about STDs?
I think that they're focused like more on the STDs because like as a teenager, you don't really think of a child as much, but like the STDs, you're like, you're just thinking about, like, oh, I'm going to get crabs or whatever.
I mean, I kind of disagree with that part. I think people worry about the teen pregnancy more than STDs because they feel like as you getting another teen pregnant, it ruins their lives, like their futures and your future goals and stuff like that.
Okay, so let's pause here for a second. I know I was just talking about how teens and condom use are such a success story, but the full picture is that condom use has pretty much leveled off. Despite the declines, teens are still the most responsible age group of all when it comes to sex. For comparison, surveys suggest that less than half of adults regularly use condoms. It makes you realize teenagers really get a bad rap.
The notion that teenagers are not responsible is a myth. And if you give people responsibility, they act responsible.
Everyone remembers that being a teenager is weird and hard and confusing. But when it comes to sex, these teens are really getting themselves educated and making smart decisions. And they're excited about spreading that knowledge around.
especially with, like, those successful workshops where people, like, actually, like, participating and stuff. And they, like, they're thanking you, like, oh, thanks, I really didn't know all these things. And it was like, I did my part today, you know?
For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop. And remember, always use a condom.
Thanks to the Community Healthcare Network and the Teens Pact Program, the students we just heard from were Dakari Santiago, Patrick Hughes, Brian Maldonado, Peter Henry, and Raheem McFarlane. It's been 40 years since Roe v. Wade, but the abortion battle rages on. On the streets, in the courts, in state legislatures. But there's a quieter fight going on in the waiting rooms of crisis pregnancy centers, places created to discourage women from getting abortions. Latino USA producer Brenda Salinas has more.
You might recognize this commercial.
Pregnant or think you might be? Well, you're not alone. We can help you. Our counselors are here to help. They are easy to talk to and more than flexible.
They're not for health clinics. They're for crisis pregnancy centers. It's hard to know what exactly happens inside one of these. They're not exactly media friendly. Feminist writer Jacqueline Munson went undercover to a crisis pregnancy center in New York.
I walked into the building and it was very clean. It was warm and it was inviting. There was nice music playing. There was a lot of women working who were very attentive.
Munson's goal is to give you a picture of what a crisis pregnancy center is really like.
A woman walking into this facility would definitely think that this could be a medical facility. There were white lab coats. They did have the model fetuses out. There were a lot of pamphlets that looked like they were medical pamphlets.
NARAL Pro-Choice's Virginia chapter gathered the audio you're hearing now.
Is this the place with the free pregnancy test?
You want a pregnancy test?
Yes, please.
Oh, here. Great.
Absolutely.
And Munson tells us about the experience she had in one of these centers here in New York.
A woman had kind of very quickly ushered me into a room.
Yeah, hi, I'm Dolores Royce Carmen.
I wasn't pregnant, of course, but, you know, they had me take a pregnancy test and then test my own urine.
No, it is a positive test. You weren't expecting that, were you?
They had asked me if I was single, if I was planning on getting an abortion, if I was planning on marrying the man who had impregnated me.
So was this like a one-night stand kind of thing? You don't even know this guy, do you, this guy, at all? Okay.
Again, just to be clear, you're hearing audio from two separate experiences of crisis pregnancy centers.
I had somebody come into the room at one point and tell me that I was too pretty to be having sex before I was married.
First of all, and I'm not judging anybody, I'm just saying, first of all, if you're not married, why are you having sex?
They build up a great trust with these women. They're very nice and they're friendly. They make it seem like they really care about you. But at the end of the day, you're a slut who got pregnant, and now we have to help you so you never get in this situation again.
But pretty soon, says Munson, it went from slut-shaming to misinforming.
A lot of heavy lecturing about abortion being implicated in breast cancer and, you know, these things that have been scientifically refuted.
But there are cases of women who have not been able to have children because they had had a previous abortion.
So the baby dies with inside you, and then the next day when you're away from all medical care in your own house, own apartment, wherever, they give you a second set of pills to take, and you wind up expelling all the products of
the You force the cervix open, you put a tube in the uterus, and you suck the baby out of the uterus.
They made me watch about a 25-minute video showing, like, an animated abortion, talking about how abortion causes breast cancer and you can die from it, the psychological implications of it.
You know what my fear would be is if you go ahead and have that abortion, have the abortion procedure, that the depression that results from that will, all that energy that you put into getting into law school will just make you crumble. You know, and that's a real thing. Depression is a real, real thing.
Anytime an innocent life is ended on purpose, mm-hmm. that's called murder.
And I can almost guarantee, even though I've never met your mother or your father, that they would love a grandbaby.
And I kind of felt bad about myself while I was sitting there, even though, you know, I wasn't pregnant. I knew I was doing an investigation. It made me feel bad about myself. So the fact that they were able to kind of get through me kind of alarmed me, because I thought to myself, there's really vulnerable women, especially in a low-income neighborhood, who come here looking for help and they're not getting the help that they need.
That's not true, says Ray Rojas. He's the Latino Outreach Director of Right to Life. He says that crisis pregnancy centers are a godsend to a pregnant woman in need.
We hook her up with food stamps, aid from the state, the city, and the federal government.
He says they also provide counseling and diapers, and they're not set up to mislead women.
Crisis pregnancy centers aren't set up to be healthcare centers. We're there to provide information, the information that women do not receive at abortion clinics.
But the New York City Council didn't see it their way. In 2011, it passed a consumer protection law requiring crisis pregnancy centers to openly specify the services they don't provide and to disclose whether or not they have a medical doctor on staff. Here's former New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn.
The law we passed here in the city is pretty simple. It says, say what you are. Say if you're a medical office. Say if you provide abortion services. Say if you provide emergency contraception. Our law supports people's First Amendment rights. It simply does not support people's rights to deceive women in the city of New York.
The American Center for Law and Justice, which is like a Christian version of the ACLU, argued that the law was violating the crisis pregnancy center's First Amendment rights. A federal court first blocked the law, but in January, most of it was upheld by a federal appeals court, which both sides interpreted as a victory. Now, the centers don't have to disclose whether they provide referrals for emergency contraception, abortion, or prenatal care. Ray Rojas from Right to Life.
They decided, for the most part, on the side of the crisis pregnancy center and said that, you know, you can't legislate freedom of speech. I mean, it's guaranteed in the First Amendment that we can say pretty much, you know, what we want. And the government can't prohibit us from saying what we need and want to say.
But they do have to say whether or not they have a doctor on staff, what kind of services they don't provide, and they have to protect their clients' privacy. Former New York City Councilwoman Jessica Lappin.
A woman has a right to know when she walks into an office if it's a medical facility or it's not. And the other big piece of this is these women give incredibly personal information to these centers. And this bill requires them to treat that confidentially.
There isn't really a clear winner or loser. More than 24 crisis pregnancy centers are still operating in New York, and their day-to-day looks pretty much the same. During the appeals court hearing, the crisis pregnancy centers admitted to purposefully setting up shop as close as possible to registered health clinics. They also have Spanish speakers out on the street ushering Latina women into their doors. It's a moral war they're waging, says Ray Rojas.
The single most dangerous place, and this is a statistic, it's not an opinion, the single most dangerous place for a Latino in these United States today is in his mother's womb.
And as long as they believe that to be true, this fight's not going anywhere. For Latino USA, I'm Brenda Salinas in New York City.
Coming up, a Super Bowl commercial causes controversy.
So beautiful for spacious skies.
Por tus olas de granos sambar. Your peachy
But is the controversy worth paying attention to? Stay with us on Latino USA.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies. And I'm not proud of my address. In the torn up town, no postcode. Yeah.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We've been talking control, and in so many ways, the idea brings up issues around health. Washington, D.C. is a city facing more than one health crisis, but one Latina has the job of trying to rein those issues in. The deputy mayor of Health and Human Services for the District of Columbia is Beatriz Bibi Otero, and she joins us from WAMU in Washington, D.C. What's your story in terms of where you grew up?
I was born in Bolivia. I came to the States, I think, when I was about 9 years old. And we landed in Washington, D.C., and we grew up in the D.C. area and went to school here with a very strong Latino Catholic home.
So did you grow up going back and forth between Bolivia?
We were fortunate enough, because of where my father worked, to have home leave. And so we went to Bolivia every couple of years, and so maintained our relationships with family, with a very large extended family. Both of my parents came from very large families.
What was it about your experience, Bibi, that made you decide not to go into business, not to become an international corporate lawyer?
I'm very committed to the District of Columbia. This is my home. And as I saw immigrant families coming in late 70s, early 80s into the District of Columbia, and the kinds of struggles between the Latino and the African-American community as families settled into what was then relatively poor African-American neighborhoods, there was a lot of the kind of struggle around others coming into the land of those who already felt like they were oppressed. And so I wanted to find ways in which our communities could, in fact, work together and thrive in developing their neighborhoods.
Do you think that there's something in particular that a Latina perspective like yours brings to the conversation between African Americans and Latinos, and making sure that this relationship is done right in terms of the future?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I have the cultural experience. I have I had the good fortune of growing up in this city from very young and interacting across all of the various groups in the District of Columbia. And I think that growing up here, I learned so much about being able to work in a white world, in an African American world, in a Latino world. I come at it understanding what the values of each of those groups are, and hopefully being able to, more than anything, share how much alike we are. And I know that sounds very much cliche-ish, but we're a lot more alike than we are different.
So Washington, D.C. has a rate of AIDS or HIV that essentially rivals some sub-Saharan African countries. So how do you even begin to tackle that?
Well, I think there were a number of things, certainly in this administration, that we did very quickly. We made commitments to making sure that people were connected to medical care within the first 3 months of being tested positive. So linking to care is a key piece. The other is really increasing our distribution of condoms, our getting needles off the streets, making sure that young people are tested early. The city really committed a great deal of its tobacco dollars to developing community clinics. And we now have some of the best community clinics in the country across the District of Columbia. And they're much more accessible than simply the hospital or your private provider.
But what do you think is the cause for these high rates of AIDS and HIV?
I think we certainly know that drugs and drug addiction and the use of needles is one. We continue to see high incidence among, I'm not really clear yet but the high incidence around women and women of color in particular. And so we're really trying to unearth what that is. I think so many of our health issues are directly linked to issues of poverty, and issues of access. And those are, I think, similar across the board in our various communities. So we have a population where 80% of our kids are in Medicaid. One of the, I think the highest if, or close to the highest in terms of accessibility to health insurance. And we've done that very deliberately in the district to make sure that even those who are undocumented, who may not have access to insurance in the more traditional ways, are insured. We're the only jurisdiction in the country that provides for that.
What parts of your job exist that people don't usually realize actually fall under the purview of Health and Human Services and being a deputy mayor?
What? Oh, my goodness. What I don't think people see is the opportunity in this position to cut across all of those systems. We often have people who are in multiple systems. We have a way to integrate our work so that the experience for people dealing with the public sector, people who have to benefit from government and all, is a much more positive experience. It's one that has a much greater sense of dignity. It's government, right? It's a structure. It's hard to figure out. It's a system that that you have to knock the doors down in order to get in. But to understand that this role, you are one of four deputy mayors. You're also partners with education and with economic development and with public safety, and which are the other major areas in our government, and the ability to cut across all of those. And I don't know if that's unique to me or what, but I'm not very good staying in my lane. And I think that has really helped a great deal broaden the influence of Health and Human Services in the city.
Thank you so much, Deputy Mayor, for joining us on Latino USA. We really enjoyed speaking with you.
It was a pleasure, Maria. Thank you.
Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services of Washington, D.C., Bibi Otero, joined us from Washington, D.C. What's more American than the Super Bowl? Could it be a can of Coca-Cola? Coke debuted this commercial during the Super Bowl. Of course, it's America the Beautiful in all of our languages. Lots of people took to social media to celebrate it, but it also caused quite a stir. Latino USA producer Brenda Salinas tells us what it's all about.
I'm going to admit, I didn't watch the Super Bowl. I don't know why, it just didn't happen for me this year. But I did see the Coke commercial later that night. My eyes got a little foggy, and I took to Twitter to say so. And then I saw these tweets. Some have been changed for grammatical reasons.
At Stefan Weber. Well, I won't be drinking Coke anymore. We speak English in the USA. Get over it.
At RightwingNut019. Melting pot means you melt together with everyone else, not hold on to old things. Shame on you, Coke.
At Silas Duguid. Coke is a segregationist company that is dividing America. The United States is an English-speaking country, and boycott Coke.
At Wittenwill. I'm pretty sure America's language is still English, last time I checked.
Whoa. But all this stuff was only showing up on my feed because people I know were retweeting it. What's up with that? I called Gene Demby over at NPR's Code Switch blog to talk about it. Hey, Gene.
Hey, Brenda. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
So, were you watching the Super Bowl?
I was.
And you saw this ad?
Yes, the ad.
It seems like every time something like this happens, there's a backlash. And then all these news outlets pick it up and make just a huge fuss.
Yeah, and this is like a genre of story at this point, right?
To me, it seems like it's a really easy way to write and talk about race without having to know any context of anything.
Right. You basically don't need to know anything. You're just like, oh, that person said a bad word. Like, you know what I mean? You could game out the conversation right now. The people are like, oh, it's freedom of speech and blah, blah, blah. You could just, you know what all the comments are going to say. And it's just not really interesting. But, you know, I don't think they'll stop being written because they're really easy to write.
And, you know, if these people have like 200 followers, are we just giving them too much attention? Because from the listicles that I've seen, the, you know, the shaming listicles, I'm seeing the same 50 tweets over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, this goes to our pet theory that there aren't that many people out there who are saying these things.
Yeah, is there something to it like, oh, you're racist, I'm not racist?
I mean, yeah, if we're being candid, I'm sure a lot of people were just soliciting cookies, right? Like, look at how racist I'm not. Like, I'm yelling at racist people on the internet, right? I mean, I think a lot of that is happening there. That's definitely a big dynamic there. It's like people want to show that they're down with multiculturalism or down with the brown, as it were. And I think that's both, on one level, kind of commendable and also kind of cheap, you know?
Yeah. But the fact that a huge company like Coke is willing to piss these people off, I mean, doesn't that say something?
I don't know if we can assume that Coke was trying to piss these people off, right? Like, that was like some kind of...
You think?
I don't know. Do you think so?
They did include the hashtag America is beautiful in the commercial. So they knew that there would be some sort of conversation.
Well, yeah, it's a Super Bowl ad. They wanted there to be a conversation, right? They want there to be...
But, I mean, yeah, they're a really smart company. First of all, I'm willing to bet that immigrants probably buy more Coke than anybody, just on numbers of how much people drink Coke in developing countries.
Huh.
And, I mean, they did kind of just make Pepsi the official drink of racists. I think that was pretty clever.
Yeah, it's weird because... You know, I mean, I don't know if they made Pepsi the official drink of races, but they probably, I could be amenable to the argument that showing diversity is a political statement of some sort. They're trying to get a message across. And one of the things Americans generally like to tell themselves is, like, we're a country of many people. I mean, you know, it's still kind of self-aggrandizing. Like, look at all the different kinds of American life there are, and look at how everyone at the end of the day just really wants a Coke. You know what I mean?
Well, we'll keep having this and other conversations on Twitter and on Facebook. What handle should we be following to get your take?
You can follow me at GEEDEE215. And you can follow my blog mates and play cousins at NPR Code Switch.
And we're at Latino USA. Thanks so much, Gene.
Thanks so much, Brenda.
Mis queridos listeners, we've spent an entire hour talking about the issue of control. Whether it's control over your own body or the way you tell a story. And I wanted to tell you about my own story about control. Several years ago, I was asked to attend a Latina empowerment conference in South Texas, and they asked me to speak very personally about my own Latina success story. The organizers told me there would be several hundred high school girls there. Those were the ones I wanted to reach, the people there who mattered most. Because for me, it was never easy to grow up Latina. I wanted the Latina teens there to know that for generations we've been riding that line between our two selves. There's our traditional, often Catholic Latina selves, bound to family and community. And conversely, our strong, free-thinking, open-minded, feminist American selves. At the conference, over 100 girls sat in the rear of the auditorium, back straight and strong, listening attentively. I had come early to hear some of the Latina speakers, but then I got confused. Women were on stage telling their stories of personal grief and eventual triumph, all of them about how they had suffered after having an abortion, but became triumphant soldiers for the pro-life movement. I picked up the flyer for the event and saw that among the sponsors for the day was a pro-abstinence organization. What to do? I didn't want to be disrespectful, but I believe in the healthy, though sometimes scary debates that are the basis for our democracy. I hadn't planned on talking about my personal life in this way exactly, but I did have my own story about grief and triumph, and it too revolved in part around pregnancy and abortion and loss and life. Having different points of view is essential, not just having them, but expressing them. I wanted the girls to learn that lesson. So I began to tell my own story. As a Mexican immigrant girl in Chicago in the 70s, I had seen graphic photographs in Time magazine, women who had died in botched illegal abortions. As access grew safer with the decision of Roe v. Wade, I grew up a product of the women's movement, smart and educated about sex. But while I was in college, I had two abortions, even though I was using birth control. There was never any thought that I would go through with the pregnancies. I wasn't in love. I wasn't getting married. I hadn't finished college. It was not going to happen. Now, having an abortion is no light matter. I was sad. But as a young woman, I was also at peace with my legal and then very private decision. Years later, married and in love, I had two miscarriages, and then I wanted a baby more than anything in the world. Seeing my immigrant paisanas in New York City who were facing uncertain lives, but having babies out of love inspired me. And so we kept trying. Now I'm a mom of two wonderful teenagers, and I brought them up knowing that openness was the only way forward. I mean, look, I wrote a memoir about my life as a Latina mom, and so my mom and dad have read it, as have my conservative family in Mexico. And they accept me, not in spite of what they might call sin, but because of love. And I'm accepted by the man I've loved for 25 years and the children we've had together. We all make hard choices, and the young women who listened to me needed to hear that they could endure those choices, to feel their strength, to feel strong enough to make someone wear a condom, to say no, to have an abortion, or to make the choice to keep a pregnancy, but mostly to own their voice and their power as young American women. When I finished speaking, I wasn't sure what to expect. But as I walked off stage, some teenage girls came running up to hug me. Now, even though I've had abortions, I, of course, would never wish that on anyone. But I have met every kind of woman who's made that choice, from a mother with three kids to a scared teen and everything in between. Their story, without fail, is the story of free women who are respected and who are given the right to choose and to make the choice that is right for them. And, mis queridos, that's it for this week's Latino USA. Our show is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, Jonathan Wolf, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Antonia Cerejido and Daniel Gunter. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Additional engineering this week by Stephanie LeBeau. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, from our studios in Harlem. And join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, where we are Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Sex.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators. Hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, whose commission to build a healthier America works to improve health where Americans live, learn, work, and play. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.